Good evening, everybody, and welcome to event 29 of the Ledbury Poetry Festival, a reading from four poets. And I must thank our sponsors, the supporters of the festival, the Arts Council. So, we've got a really interesting collection of poets for you tonight. First is Rachel Mann. Rachel started writing in the late 1990s as a result of major ill health. She was already living in Manchester, and now she's poet in residence in Manchester Cathedral and the vicar of a church in the Manchester area. In between reviewing rock music, particularly folk, prog and metal, Rachel has written two books, Dazzling Darkness and The Risen Dust. Please welcome Rachel Mann.
Working it out. Then a girl, a teen, tangerine in cheap spray tan, clicks onto the bus and sways towards the back, her arse a rolling fleshy pendulum in retro jeans, her ease in 4-inch heels, the hypnosis of that arse she wields like a weapon, playing with her body as if she were a puppeteer, adjusting a new doll's strings. A girl trying out what it's like to be a girl trying to be a woman. Watching her from a distant evening, where I'm 24 again, conscious of those twin mounds on my chest, secretly raised over months, a pioneer shoveling earthworks at night, afraid to be seen, my stinging eyebrows thin as stiletto tips, the two bright lipstick huge on my lips, my eyes fixed 10 feet ahead, and I'm flicking my own weak, tight male ass out far and wide, side to side, picking my way down the street as if to a metronome's click, as if this will grow it fat and round as an orange, flicking it like a boy, working out what it is to be a girl, working out what it is to be a woman. It's great to be here tonight. It's great to share a platform, a stage with three very intimidating poets. I mostly want to share some newer stuff tonight, thus lots of bits of paper. It's good to sort of try new stuff out, but I thought I'd try a couple of older things as well. I spend far too much of my life being ill, far too much time, and sometimes that generates poetry. The risen life. You wake to a sting between the shoulder blades, as if someone's folded a crease down your back. The silence hurts and the light unexpected, grey, not quite morning, glowing at the edges, as if electric is involved. So many people lying down, confined, each in their own bay. The slow heave of chests, a faint scent, antiseptic perhaps, the calm. Not remembering for a second what has happened to you. Then feeling out from the inside a kind of shock, shivering down through your forehead, teeth, neck. A fear about what might have been removed. There is a nurse. She could be a nurse. Someone who smiles, who is not afraid of wounds, whose eyes twinkle as she holds a finger to her mouth when you begin to speak. Ascending. To cast off weight, to hollow out bones, to bend her voice higher, reaching. She has strength enough for that, for pushing the feathers out, to force the unexpected notes up through her throat. She is coming down to what she has left. She is discovering sound, coos and trills, body as flute. Nothing will hold her long. She could rise as easily as dust. I'm really fascinated by notions of transgression, partly being a trans woman. That's just the nature of the beast. But of course, I always want to sort of, as a religious person, as a vicar, I'm looking to find ways to weave transgression into that narrative. This is a poem about the character of Jael, who famously stuck a tent peg in a bloke's head in the Old Testament. Tent peg. He wanted no fuss, just water and a place to rest, a blanket like a child. I gave him milk, smoothed the rug, lit candles, ran my hand across his dripping forehead. It was his smile I loved, unreserved like a baby discovering movement for the first time. The way he wanted to place his hand in mine, just to know there was someone else in the dark. I let him sleep. If he needed to run, let him do that in dreams. He had done enough. The peg might have been made for him. How easily it slid in, his head soft ground. It was not how you think. He gurgled like a newborn, his legs kicking once. He might have said my name. I have problems sleeping, and the next series of poems are around that issue, but also to do with identity as well, me trying to figure out who I am in this body, in this time. Awake at 3 a.m., what is known? That somewhere else, in Anadyr or Kamchatka, say, a man is organizing his regrets into a song, searching down through the arpeggios for a proper place to start. Further out still, a wolf reveals its own heartbreak. By a lake, a shivering child skims stones. Insomniac. At night, in the city, a desert drifts through her, a fine dust first gathering at the lips of roads, specks of glass staining windscreens, the tip of a Sirocco. No end. Cars hushed to a whisper, pools of water, parks, supermarkets smothered. Soon the pilgrims, traders carrying her burdens, caravans of gold and ivory, spice, the rewards of empires, cage after cage of slaves, billowing silk, roofs of coloured stars. Further out, people gather at trees, at Mamre, for honey cakes. Sherbet smiles. She tries and tries, but never arrives. Still too far, lost amid the rust of wars, tanks and chariots, rotting barrels, cleaved skulls. Dunes swallow street lights, flickering before the cold. A silent dawn. I really struggle sometimes to make sense of the fact that I was born and raised a boy, and I'm just working on a number of poems that look through that and weave that through my insomnia. So I'm sorry if this is a bit rough in places. Boy child, follow the path through edgeless fields of meadow sweet, of hop towers, fruiting totems of green, to the place we always go. Knowing the truth, light is temporary, the trumpet is forever about to sound. Out here the earth's lungs splutter and cease. Self breaks shell of self, spills the yolk of dreaming, membrane of you and me. I know you still, how you played as if summer was a time for slaughter, fighting endless wars, waiting to ambush the ghost of that in which we can no longer believe. I meet you rarely now, even in the grace of dreams, your face kind or unkind, bewildered, tilting your head in wonder at the things we've done. So I'm keeping an eye on the time here. One of the things that I really struggle with, sorry, I sound like everything, it's a struggle today. Probably is a bit. It's been a long day. Oh, goodness me, I'll bore you later. I'm currently attempting to scribble a PhD on 19th century women's poetry, and I'm looking particularly at the notion of fecundity and barrenness in that, and of course that raises some interesting things if you're a trans woman. What on earth does fecundity, a term which is always exclusively applied to women, mean if you're a trans woman? And I wanted to launch this sequence upon you, but I'm only kind of confident about one bit of it, so I'm afraid you're only going to get part one. But I'm hoping that it will go on and on and on and on and on. The Children has an epigraph. One does not give birth in pain. One gives birth to pain. Julia Kristeva. One, stillborn. Your hair, fronds of autumn, caked across your head. Your eyes, blue-green as Odysseus's sea. That is how I think of you, arriving alone. No heralds to make a ceremony. Nothing to offer except your body's slick completeness. And when I hold you, cradling your head like porcelain lifted from 2,000-year-old clay, I swear it is the world which shivers, not you or me. Knowing I would know you anywhere, in any time, like old lovers telling the morning's mood in the lift of a shoulder, the rise and fall of a chest, letting gesture, become the way the day gathers strength. And if you lived for minutes or years, if you breathed once or not at all, you could do no more. To have held you is enough. Oh, forever. More than enough. I think I've got time for two more. It's all right. I was asked recently to write a whole series of poems for some new Stations of the Cross, which appeared in Manchester Cathedral. And I was going to read a whole bunch of these, but I'm just going to stick to one. Time has almost caught us. Simon of Cyrene. Simon, of course, famously carried the cross, lifted Jesus up. Simon of Cyrene, all I wanted was to lift you up and walk away. But you grew small, curled down into my hand, nestling like a mouse preparing for winter. How easy it would have been to finish it there, to crush you, to save everyone the trouble. Or to run, carry you off, find somewhere dark to sleep, to heal as we dreamed. But no, we walked as they commanded us, you growing tall again, the look on your face as we reached the hill, furious, as if to say, why didn't you take your chance? And then finally, feels a bit naughty really doing this, but nonetheless, it means an awful lot to me, this poem. It's called Dress, and I suppose it reflects some of my longings as a trans person growing up. And I've actually labelled it after Olds, because it was Sharon Olds who kind of inspired me with this, really. So, Dress, after Olds. Heart red, cut knee red, made from pearl cotton, the luster of sunset on a lake. But not for showing off, not a take me out, let stars fall from the sky, firecracker kind of dress. Just a dress for an 8-year-old girl, a simple pinafore, to be worn on boring Saturdays watching TV, drowsy from the scent of baking seeping under the kitchen door. A small flower near the hem, perhaps, a daisy stitched in by mum, something to pick at, fray, one day dig out. A dress maybe never even worn, just hung in the wardrobe, occasionally seen, touched, smiled upon. To simply have known it was mine. In those days, to have had something. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rachel Mann. Next we have Chris Beckett. Chris has been writing poetry since he was 12 years old. Although he was born in London, he grew up mainly in Ethiopia, and he's translated a great deal of Amharic Ethiopian poetry. His most recent book, Ethiopia Boy, is, not surprisingly, about Ethiopia, and is written in imitation of Ethiopian praise poems. So please give a welcome to Chris Beckett.
Go completely dry in reading, so it's nice to know that that's there. I'm going to start with some poems by Bukutu Sayum, who I've been translating for a few years now, and he came over to represent Ethiopia at Parnassus, the South Bank, in 2012, wasn't it? Yeah. So I thought I'd read you just to get an idea of the voice. I think I'm standing too close. So I'll read it in Amharic first. The title in English is I Won't Climb a Mountain. It's the first in this little pamphlet. Alwatam terara. Alwatam terara. Dumanam le dabbus. Kissed the manawan shikab le kullabus. Alwasamune. Kabunatekle kunf. Kayakab muslal. Une motatsa sub. Samayu zuk yilal. I won't climb a mountain. I won't climb a mountain to touch the clouds. I won't lift the frown of a rainbow into a smile. I won't borrow Tekla Hymenot's wings or Jacob's ladder. When I want to climb, the sky will come down to me. He's got a sort of comic strand going on in his work, Borkutu, but he's also, I mean, for me, he's basically a political poet. But in Ethiopia, you can't really criticize the government because you get locked up. So this is, it's a fairly political poem. And I've heard, when I first heard this poem, Ethiopians, it was in Addis Ababa, and Ethiopians gasped. It's called In Search of Fat. So again, I think I'll read it to you in Amharic, and I probably don't sound at all like Borkutu, but anyway, he's not here. Hasasa Saga. Alev ke sitaoch, ketono ye mogagu. Sagachan yet hede, bolo si fellago. Baye shenterru, baye te gatagu. Asaso, asaso, bemeder, besemai. Again you'd borch hono, baanso, gulalai. In search of fat, a multitude of thin people. All skin, call out like rag and bone men, where's our fat? They rummage every mountain, every stone, and huddle, search in the soil, search in the sky, and at last they find it, piled up on one man's belly. And I'll do one more of Borkutu's. You'll see how my poems are so different. this is called Prohibited. Kulkul no. Machas kulkul no. Mefachet kulkul no. Meshinat kulkul no. Ketkedaba mullu. Tesertoba kulkul. Yetu no to kulkul. Unlef. Ketkedawana unlef. Hail badaleng. Mekulkul kulkul no. Yemilt azisa lenya. Prohibited. Smoking is prohibited. Whistling is prohibited. Peeing is prohibited. The whole wall made up of prohibitions. Which one's right? Were I blessed with one piece of wall, a little piece of power, my slogan would be, prohibitions are prohibited. Borkutu writes from a mixture of traditions. Really, he writes from the religious. They have a whole religious poetry which is short and punchy. And he writes from that, but he also writes in a sort of praise poem mode as well. And my poems are really imitations of praise poems. And the first one is about Abebe, our son, our cook's son, who was the boy I really, really, really fancied. Really missed when I found out later that he'd died. This is, I suppose, a praise shout. And the sort of technique of a praise shout is that it's for an important person. And so you repeat this person's name at the beginning of each line. This is just the way it goes. And the reason for that is probably that you get his attention. You keep him there. He can't go anywhere because you're nailing him by his name. Abebe, the cook's son. Abebe from a distant afternoon. Abebe from an afternoon where everybody naps. Even the donkeys propped against trees on their little hoofs. Abebe tall as a eucalyptus tree. Abebe black all over when he pisses on a eucalyptus tree. Who jaunties down dirt tracks to the honey shop, buys two drippy honeycombs in a box. Abebe, the cool boy, in drainpipe jeans and sky blue sneakers. Abebe, the busy crossing where girls stop to chat, who clicks his fingers to the funky Ibex band as we saunter back up track. Abebe calling, come here, to the dog called, come here. Abebe trotting round the dog yard like a horse, who saddles up the smoky horses and takes me prairie galloping, who makes a dash at mud caves where hyenas sleep, who shows me how to cook qualima beef and ginger sausages and a chickpea fish for Lent. Abebe, gobbling up the afternoon like a qualima. Abebe, grinning like a chickpea fish while everybody naps. I used to go to school in a bus, and the buses were called lion buses and are still called lion buses. And the lion in Ethiopia, the black lion, is sort of like it was Haile Selassie's symbol, the Lion of Judah. And it basically stands for the state. And there's a sort of tradition of, if you want to criticize the government, you can't do it openly. So you take some symbol or some animal or something and you really criticize it. So this is in that tradition of anti-praise poem, a sort of insult poem. And it's called Lion Buses. Nothing like a lion bus. You who honk and stagger down Progress Through Cooperation Avenue. You who lick us with diesel, swaying this way and that with your shopping and hot flesh. Where is your pride, lion bus? Where is the lioness to do your hunting of kudu and goat while you snooze under a tree? We don't believe that lions can be buses. We don't believe that painting Anbusa on a bus in big gold letters changes you, you slow slug of metal, you cramper of knees and buttocks. Yes, there are cars that run like the wolf. There are small trucks as patient as donkeys. But then there are buses. Buses. They're still as awful as they were. We went back in 2007 and they're still there, lion buses, still, you know, these ancient old Fiat buses, still, you know, left over by the Italians in 1941 and still going strong, belching out diesel fumes, and everybody in Addis hates them. One of the things I remember so much about Ethiopia is the music. And Abebe was, of course, a musician later on, but he was always singing when I knew him. He was always listening to music. And there's a sort of type of music called Ethiopian jazz. And they have some really famous exponents of it. One of whom is called Mahmoud Ahmed. And he won a BBC Music Award in 2010, I've got it here, I think. 2007, in fact. And he often comes to the South Bank, but I'd never heard of him until I went to Ethiopia and was reminded, actually, of who he was. And this is a poem called Lemon for Love, and it's the title of one of his songs. What's interesting for me about it is that when you write about yourself as a child, as I'm doing here, sometimes you find yourself, quite often you find yourself, your younger self looking forward, and you're looking back and your younger self is looking forward, and that's what this poem is about. Today, Mahmoud Ahmed is singing again, wailing out of Abebe's radio, lemon for love, lemon for love, lemon, you are so sweet. His voice is long and stringy as a branch. It throws the lemon down at his girlfriend's feet. Lemon for love! Lemon, you are so tasty. Now the chorus is shouting, oh, lo, 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 clapping all its hands, stamping its 50 feet. Now Abebe's fingers are jumping and clicking, shoulders shaking, knees popping, because the girl in the song is beautiful as Makata, queen of Sheba. And yes, she has bent to pick up the lemon. Mahmoud Ahmed, you must never stop singing. Your voice can make anything happen. It twists around my brain like the roots of a tree. It opens a fresh leaf in my heart. Mahmoud Ahmed, if I sit here by Abebe's radio, will you throw my lemon for me? I forgot an important line in that poem. I was going so fast I missed it. The fourth stanza says, lemon for love, lemon you are so tasty. If she picks it up, It means she will marry him. That's a rather crucial line. And I took a long gap before, and that was because I realized I'd left out the line. Didn't know what to do. I went to an exhibition of an Ethiopian photographer in Covent Garden a few years ago, and one of the photographs was of Haile Selassie and Queen Elizabeth coming out of Africa Hall after a banquet. And I realized that it was a banquet that my parents had been at. And so I was looking at this photograph to see if I could see my parents, you know, and all these people coming out, you know, wearing their ball gowns and their you know, their morning suits and stuff. And I couldn't find them. And Shimelis Desta, the photographer, came up to me and said, why are you looking so closely? And I said, well, I'm looking for my parents. And so we looked together for my parents. And it just made such an impression on me. We didn't find them. But a poem came out. It's called The Banquet. And of course, everybody thinks of Ethiopia for famine. The Banquet. Eyoha, Haile Selassie, King of Kings, and your shining guest, Elizabeth. It is nighttime, maybe 12. You burst through walls of flash photography, waving little finger wands. Are you conjuring the spirits? Are you bewitching your peoples? Daytime beggars, show us sores and stumps. Stick hungry babies under our noses. Even your lions have no teeth in the sunshine. But at night, you throw the ugly out, put the young and restless in their beds, and switch on all the lights in your squares and palaces. Then policemen bounce up on the stage and sing like whistles. Imperial guards play saxophone in natty suits. And parents, well, they rush off with a little kiss to the Romanians or Hamlet in Amharic. Then on to Zebra for a drink, or is it Dik Dik? Where the swizzle sticks are made of gold and gunfights crackle like the gangsters in a poster at Ras Hailu's cinema. And somewhere in the shadows of the banquet, where tables groan with meat and fish, my mother is swishing her lovely ball gown. She has spent the whole afternoon backcombing her hair into a fairy tale, stiffening it with puffs of Elnet, sliding her warm bosoms into the tipsy balcony, so she can dote on my father's arm, just out of sight. And he will stand there, stiffly, beaming. Famine. I was looking for a way to write about famine, and I found an anthology of famine poems, oral poems, and they were just incredible. So I just collaged different lines from all these different poems written by people who had been suffering through the big 1980s famine. And one of the poems goes, it's sort of, the book was divided into different stages of famine. So pre the famine, during the famine, then afterwards. And this is the title of this poem, which is To the Man with a Guzzler Wife, comes from the pre, what to do before the famine strikes. You who have a guzzler wife, divorce her and wait for me. Me being the famine. Because the other thing about praise poetry in Ethiopia, which I find so amazing, is that they often write boast poems, self-praise poems, but in the voice of the thing that they hate. So this is the famine talking. My name is Dubala, voice of famine. I'm a hot wind in the marketplace. Soon I will hammer on your flimsy door. Here I am with wide open eyes, with my eyes that are burning. You should look for a shrub to hide under. I will suck the waters from your rivers. Chew the beans on your coffee bushes. Brown the grass so your cows shrink to no milk. Do not boast your so-and-so's friend. Do not big talk You're the son of Mr. Rich. I've seen you by the road with your begging bag. The last injera is baked, but brother swears to brother, I have not one inch of eating left. Yes, salvation of the soul is a thing of the past. I am bad days coming, and days that are worse than that. I am the end of, here comes a donkey loaded with lentils. The start of, I swapped my mother for a tabba of beans. I am the green algae choking your well water. The hand who gives your sister to the vultures. The poor are beating me. Oh, the rich hurt my eyes. Every single one of those lines written by people suffering from famine. And I took that poem to a workshop and they said that it was too violent, that the hand who gives your sister to the vultures was not believable. I'm going to end with a musho, a lament for my friend Abebe. What should I say about this? Abebe means flowering. Ababa is a flower. Addis Ababa means new flower. Abebe is flowering. And he was I didn't know this, but as an adult he was a carpenter, really fantastic carpenter, apparently made lots of cupboards. And he was also a guitarist and songwriter. And this is actually, this poem interesting for me because it was a mixture of an Ethiopian musho, but also of a poem I really like by Mazizi Kunene, the South African poet, an elegy he wrote for one of his friends. And I've borrowed a couple of lines from Kunene. Cupboards and a guitar. Most people die once. That is the general rule. Death does not like people who die twice or more. It is too much work, too much grief. But Abebe, the slim, good-looking boy, who became a man when I was not looking, when I was out collecting firewood. The skillful carpenter, whose cupboards have been called brave and devoted, because they defend their contents against all enemies. Whose guitar playing was so clear and natural that it was compared to the sound of walking. This generous boy has just died for the third time. First in my head, during the Red Terror, his smiling body shot to pieces at a demo, or thrown at Eritrea like a hand grenade. Mig deafened, squandered, exploded in a gully, left to wither in his green fatigues, the wind not even knowing he was dead. Then again, 5 years ago, from dragon beer and tej, slumped on a carpet of empties in his crumpled, dirty shirt, alone a week before they found him and his lips that had lost their grin. You loose wire of a bachelor who fathered cupboards and songs, while all around his sturdy friends were busy making 8 or 10 God-fearing boys and girls to populate the country with good, milky smells and talking. And now, today, a Monday, off the Yeka Road, where he lived as a boy, Abebe dies for the third time. When Aster's son says, Abebe died of drink. Yes, Abebe died. And you, his mother and sisters and cousins, you, his many customers and admirers, look how he continues to die. When our thoughts fly to him like songbirds, when we gather to praise him and listen to his guitar with every ear in our head and our hearts, and a thin, scratchy voice that is so modest we had almost forgotten it, a voice that slips out of our ears. is singing Abebe's version of Bob Dylan or Tillahun. When we spot a cupboard in a shop window whose sturdy doors shout, "Nothing inside us will come to any harm." Because if Abebe was the kind of boy whom death loves like a brother, who dies just once, that his dust settles lightly and quick, how could he keep on tumbling off the shelf of our mind's eye and break into 100 songs? Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. That was wonderful stuff. And still it goes on. Our third poet this evening is Kai Miller. Kai was born and raised in Kingston, Jamaica. In 2004, he left for England to study for an MA in creative writing. And in 2006, his first book of poetry was released, Kingdom of Empty Bellies. This was shortly followed by a collection of short stories, The Fear of Stones. And his most recent collection is The Cartographer Tries to Map a Way to Zion. Kai divides his time between Jamaica and the UK, where he's here for us tonight. So give a welcome, Kai Miller.
Hi, good night. I wasn't going to begin with this poem. But after Chris read so much about Ethiopia, I thought I would, and it's actually the very first poem in the book. One of the most incredible moments in Jamaica's history is in 1966 when Haile Selassie visits Jamaica, and that day is called Groundation Day. And the whole collection is reflecting on the politics of ground, and so that's why it begins with this collection. My grandmother, who has weird experiences, lets things slip, sometimes just offhandedly. She told me the other day about, when Haile Selassie came to Jamaica and she went to the governor's house and she danced with him. I thought, you danced with Haile Selassie? And she said, yes, but he's so short. Groundation. So begin this thing with an abuye, 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 a heart bless. Step out from the case of your sandals, stand shoeless. Allow your knees and then your forehead an intimacy with stone, know your ground. The emperor that landed here in 1966 was led down his ites and gold and green plain by a Rasta man. And tell me, was it all for show, the way he scorned the red rolled out for him? He walked instead on common ground, the hem of Selassie's trousers brushed the dust of Babylon. Reach through history, touch this kneeling crowd, the tarmac soft against the substance of its faith. This is the poem I was actually going to begin with. And as I said, as you'll see, the whole collection thinks about maps and how we map places. But one of the early poems thinks about Jamaica before it was mapped. Obviously, I come from a place that in people's imagination is paradise, which is a kind of revisionist history. Certainly the first people who landed in Jamaica did not think it was paradise. Unsettled. So consider an unsettled island inside the unflattened and unsugared fields, inside a tegareg sprawl of roots and canopies, inside the tall centuries of bloodwood and yokewood and sweetwood, of dogwood, of bullet trees so hard they will one day splinter cutlasses, will one day swing low the carcasses of slaves, inside a crawling broad all of vines, unseemly flowers that blossom from their spines, inside the lego orchids and labrishing hibiscuses that throw raucous syllables at crows whose heads are red as anatters inside, malarial mosquitoes that rise from stagnant ponds inside, a green humidity thick as mud inside, the stinging spurge, the night shades, the Madame fates inside, spiders, gnats and bees, wasps and lice and fleas inside, the dengue, the hookworm, the heat and botheration inside, unchecked maca sharp as crucifixion. This is no paradise, not yet, not this unfriendly, untamed island, this unsanitized, unstructured island, this unmannered, unmeasured island, this island unwritten, unsettled, unmapped. I'll just read a few of the main sequences, the title sequence. The cartographer tries to map a way to Zion, which is really just me trying to write about post-colonial theory and hide and not make it sound academic. But the cartographer gets into a conversation about mapping. I'll just read about six or so quick poems from the sequence, and it gives you a sense. There are about 30 poems. I obviously won't read all of them. And then I'll read other poems outside of it. So this is how the sequence begins. The cartographer tries to map a way to Zion, one in which the cartographer explains himself. You might say my job is not to lose myself exactly, but to imagine what loss might feel like. The sudden creeping pace, the consultation with trees and blue fences and whatever else might prove a landmark, my job is to imagine the widening of the unfamiliar and also the widening ache of it. To anticipate the ironic question, how did we find ourselves here? My job is to untangle the tangled, to unworry the concerned, to guide you out from cul-de-sacs into which you may have wrongly turned. Two, in which the Rastaman disagrees. The Rastaman has another reasoning. He says, no, that man's job is never straight forward or easy. Him work is to make thin and crushable all that is big and as real as ourselves, is to make flat all that is high and rolling, is to make invisible and worthless plenty things that poor people can't do without, like board houses and the corner shop from which Miss Katie sell her famous peanut porridge. And then again, the map maker's work is to make visible all them things that should have never exist in the first place, like the conquest of pirates, like borders, like the viral spread of governments. Three, the cartographer says, no, what I do is science. I show the land as it is without bias. I never fall in love. I never get involved with the muddy affairs of land. Too much passion unsettles the hand. I aim to show the full of a place in just a glance. Four, the Rastaman thinks, draw me a map of what you see, and I will draw a map of what you never see. And guess me whose map will be bigger than whose. Guess me whose map will tell the larger truth. And so it goes on, this conversation, for 30 poems. I'll read a couple more. Sometimes when I visit Jamaica, one of the very frustrating things is trying to ask for directions. So I've made the cartographer experience what I tend to experience in those situations. 10, in which the cartographer asks for directions. Sometimes the cartographer gets frustrated when he asks an informant how to get to such and such a place, and the informant might say something like, all right, you know the big white house at the bottom of Clover Hill with all the windows them board up and with an eye shingle roof that look almost like a church? Yes, the cartographer says. And in front of the house, you always see an old woman, only 3 teeth in her mouth, and she's out there selling pepper shrimp in a school chair with an umbrella tied to it. And beside her, she always have 2 mongrel dogs, and one of them is white, and the other one is brown. Yes, I know exactly where you mean, the cartographer says. And in the yard, there's a big guinea tree that hang right out to the road. So school picnic always stop there to buy shrimp and eat free guinea. Yes, yes, the cartographer insists. I know it. Good, says the eye foreman, because you must go there. Eleven. At other times he's amazed by the hems and haws and shrugs of our roads, how they never run sure but seem to arc or bend or narrow just so. An avenue will turn on itself as if to give you back a place you have just come from. Lady Musgrave's road was laid in its serpentine way so that Miss Musgrave, on her carriage ride home, would not have to see a nigger man's property so much bigger than her husband's own. She did not want to feel the carriage slow. And no, her driver had just then turned his face to Devon House, a thing wet like pride in his eyes and nodding to himself. Yes, is Mrs. de Belleville that? And to think that such spite should pass down even to the present generation, should dictate the thoughtless, ungridded shape of our city, the slowness of traffic each evening, to think that one woman's pride should add so much to our daily commute. This is something the cartographer does not wish to contemplate. Still, he wonders if on his map he could make our roads a little smoother, a little straighter, as if in drawing he might erase a small bit of history's disgrace. So now on and on it goes. I'll read some poems outside of the sequence. This poem is for one of my dearest friends who died. She was Hanna Andronikova. She was a Czech novelist. And she died way too early from breast cancer. In the moment of her illness, there was a moment that she asked her closest friends to pray for her. And she said it didn't matter what faith he came from. She desired prayer in this moment, that we all had to sink our watches and pray. And in that moment, I happened to be in New Orleans on a bayou. The two things are happening, that I'm thinking of praying for Hannah. I'm on this bayou. The boat that I'm on comes towards a beaver. And the beaver, who I imagine that animals in the wildlife, when you come across them, they scamper away. And the beaver held its ground. It was so superior. It just stared us down. And I thought there was something really, really wonderful about this beaver who owned his place. In that landscape. And so the poem is about the beaver as well. It's called A Prayer for the Unflummoxed Beaver. A prayer for the unflummoxed beaver, so unmoved by the boat's slow approach, the boat drifting across the flat green acre of water. A prayer for these acres of water, which in the soft light seem firm. The squirrels, however, are never taken in. A prayer for the squirrels and their unknowable but perfect paths. See how they run across the twisting highway of cedars, but never crash. A prayer for the cedars and their dead knees rising from the water like tombstones. A prayer for the cedar balls that break when you touch them and stain your fingers yellow, that release from their tiny bellies the smell of old churches, of something holy. A prayer returned to the holy alligators. You owe them that at least. For just last night when you thought of Hanna Andronikova, you asked them to pray with you, knowing that their prayers are potent. At night, the grass is full of their red eyes. A prayer for the grass, which the alligators divide in the shape of a never-ending S. You lean over to pull some into the boat in Burma. This is called kanapaw and can be cooked with salt and oil. A prayer for the languages we know this landscape by, for the French, as spoken by fat fishermen, the fat fishermen who admit to the water we all dying. You understand, savant? A prayer for the dying that will come to all of us, but may it come soft as a boat drifting across the bayou. May it find us unrattled and as unflummoxed as the beaver. There are quite a few weird elegies in this. Anyway, my mother's Atlas of Dolls. I don't think I have to explain anything. The poem explains itself. Unable to travel, my mother makes us promise to always bring back dolls. As if glass eyes can bear sufficient witness to where she has not been, the what of the world she has not seen. She gathers them, cloth and porcelain pageant on her whatnot, makes them stand regal on white doilies, waving like queens from their high balconies. Miss Columbia, Miss Holland, Miss Peru are just a few who observe unblinking the new world about them. I think of how we arrange the dead like dolls, how we set their arms in precise positions, how we touch their unseeing eyes, and how they lie so sweetly still within their perfect boxes. It may have been the dolls that taught my mother how to die, how to travel once again, how to wave goodbye. And this is just, another, since I'm going into the morbid. In 2010, there was, as close as you could get to a civil war in Jamaica. The police went into an area called Tivoli Gardens looking for a drug lord called Dudus Coke. Yeah, a drug lord called Coke. And in the process of storming this community, 81 people were killed in that one day. This is in 2010. Other things, in Jamaica, how we talk about something that happened long ago is that we'd say, that are from when Wapi killed Philip. I've never understood this. I keep on looking up into the archives to see who was Wapi and who was Philip and when did this murder occur. But in Jamaica, if you say, that happened a long time ago, you will say, yes, man, they've been married a long time. They're married from when Wapi killed Philip. Or they've been building this house a long time. Or they're building this house from when Wapi killed Philip. And the other thing to know is that in Haitian culture, which I'm not from Haiti, but Haitian culture, Papa Gede is the person who guides the dead, who welcomes the dead. He's always smoking a cigar. He's a very dandy. He's always in the top hat, Papa Gede. So Philip plays the role of Papa Gede, 2010. This is my people's measure of long time, that are from when Wapi killed Philip. Long ago crime recounted now in folk chronometry. Philip, we might imagine, was once Philip, name since rounded out like river stone by the flow of our Creole, or maybe just the accent of earth, the way a piece of grung might open its mouth to say the name of one whose blood it has absorbed. Recent sighting of Philip takes place under a June plum tree in Tivoli. He greets 81 duppies that rise like roses from their bullet-ridden corpses, walking towards them. He raises two fingers to his lips, puffs in and out the vapors of his ghostly self. Well, he says, is dead Olive or no dead? Welcome to the dread circle of carnage, blade to blade, bullet to bullet, body to body. This is our country. So I'll just read about two more. This is a very short one. I mean, this is the shortest poem in the collection. And it's just called Distance. Distance is always reduced at night. The drive from Kingston to Montego Bay is not so far, nor the distance between ourselves and the stars. And at night there is almost nothing between the things we say and the things we mean. And finally I'll read what I often think is the darkest poem in this collection, but it appears the most comical to some. In 1992, a cargo ship traveling from China to the USA got into some problems, and lots of the cargo was overturned into the ocean, and it released into the ocean 28,000 rubber ducks, and they've been sailing all over the world since. It's been quite amazing. And scientists actually use these rubber ducks to track the movement of the currents, blah, blah, blah. And you actually get money if you spot any of these rubber ducks. You can turn it back into the company. And of course, I mean, again, you know, the whole collection, I'm thinking about how do we map the world, whether through dolls or through this bayou or through ducks sailing all across the world, which is just incredible. Of course, I think that what is happening beneath the poem, that I don't mind if you don't get it or not, I think it is a poem about the transatlantic movement of slaves as well. But that's pretty much buried. But the poem is called When Considering the Long, Long Journey of 28,000 Rubber Ducks. To them who knew to break free from dark hold of ships, who trusted their unsqueezed bodies instead to the Atlantic, to them who scorned the limits of bathtubs, refused to join a chorus of rub-a-dub, to them who've always known their own high tunes, hitched rides on the manacled backs of blues, who've been sailing now since 1992, to them that pass in squeakless silence over the Titanic, float in and out of salty vortexes, to them who grace the shores of hot and frozen continents, who instruct us yearly on the movement of currents, to those bright yellow dots that crest the waves like spots of praise. Hail. Thank you.
Thank you, Kai Miller. And now it's on to our last poet, Gregory Woods. Gregory retired recently as Professor of Gay and Lesbian Studies at Nottingham Trent University, the first such appointment in the UK. Five volumes of his poetry have been published by Carcanet Press, the most recent being An Ordinary Dog. The Myth of the Last Taboo, a collection of his essays in queer film and cultural studies, will be published this year. Please welcome Gregory Woods.
Come, hungry muses, sink your fangs into the rancid meat of things. Give us another of those songs that fizz the spittle on your tongues. Descend on us in raucous gangs, tattooed and sporting nipple rings. Evacuate those tarry lungs and goad us with your humour's prongs. Conciliate your hunger pangs with scraps of life, the random slings and arrows felt by human throngs. Forgather where the tyrant hangs and harry anyone who brings to human rights inhuman wrongs.
It's just a brief courtesy to the muses. A little sonnet there for you. My lover loves me with kid gloves. That is, no matter who's above and who beneath, we use a sheath. We never screw without a condom. He holds me in such high regard, he shields me like a bodyguard. Although love's dart has hit my heart, he fired it safely in a condom. Security is what we crave to save us from an early grave. Our greatest wealth, each other's health, safely invested in a condom. Whenever he comes home from work, he brings me bribes, inducements, perks. But of his gifts, the one that lifts my spirit most is a pack of condoms. Although his clothes are always fine, Comme des Garçons and Calvin Klein, he looks his best when he's undressed, yet even better in a condom. Among the catalogue of skills which generate our thrills and spills, his special knack is to unpack, unroll, and lubricate a condom. Without the taste for being chaste, we use a lube that's water-based, and take great care never to tear the tender membrane of our condom. As long as he takes care of me, I am not scared of HIV. My lover loves me with kid gloves, but loves me most of all with condoms. I wrote that for a Safer Sex leaflet in the 1980s. Poetry can make something happen, or something not happen. I'm reading poems on this particular theme because we had the earlier discussion, 50 Shades of Gay. So I'm choosing to make this a fairly gay reading, though I think it'll be the half Monty rather than the full thing. A blind man looks at a boy. The smell of oranges. I could have been satisfied with that. The spray, like an impolite but fragrant sneeze. I could have introverted all my senses, had I any sense, and felt a thumbnail underneath the peel prepare to flay the pulp. No need for an ending, no need to taste the fruit. I could have sat here at my desk and been tempted by all manner of profanities, my fingers dancing on the blotting paper, sticky but as chaste as apathy, the orange rolling on the carpet out of reach. It would have been a simple life, a hive of discipline. Instead, the tilt of my tentative radar locates a baffle at the centre of the room. My voice comes back to me a little late, diverted, each syllable coerced into the service of a boy's physique. Who's there? Reverberates on drum skin, naked abdomen. A slight acoustic flurry, amplified within the vortex of his navel, makes me sound concussive, tremulous. I seem to have decided, and been right, he won't reply. The light is thick, life short, the stillness of the evening air transfigured by the delicate pomander of his balls. The other thing I think I'm doing tonight is concentrating mainly on poems that rhyme, though I do a whole range of different sorts of things. I like the way that rhyme can deal with obsession and turn it into something impersonal. A footnote to this poem, this was a poem written for Michael Schmidt at Carcanet Press. A carcan is an iron collar. A carcanet is a gold necklace. Service. For all that he's a sullen brute, his pout is cute. In silhouette, the bursting of a rotten fruit, it putters, muttering his fret, expressive, though completely mute. His lips could flay a clarinet, his tongue electrocute a flute. Worth challenging to a duet, with fists like his, he could transmute a fight into a minuet, a blunderbuss into a lute. Within some squalid oubliette, he strips down to his birthday suit, tattoo and hand-rolled cigarette, the remnants of his ill repute. His nakedness no less a threat than, uniformed in hot pursuit of somebody to shoot or pet, more rigid than in full salute. How could one get this dun cadet to proffer, if not prostitute himself, develop the coquette within the manly absolute? I'd tempt him to forget regret, that fetter to the dissolute. To whet his appetite, I'd let him flatten me with his hirsute anatomy, the better yet his persecution to refute. I'd lick his feet, sweet etiquette, recruit his sweat, and substitute his carcan with a carcanet. Here's a poem about Henry James. One for the master. In clauses so subordinate they grovel to distant and aloof main verbs, my novel attempts to fascinate the feckless young with written language's prosthetic tongue. But even its most tantalizing grammar is too dull to distract them from a glamour more aphrodisiac by far than these parentheses within parentheses. There is a purpose to such Chinese boxes. They keep one safe from love and other poxes. Against perfection. Much as a virgin's shyness is more secure than sureness, to any sum a minus comes as an added bonus. The losers beat the gainers when cheated of the honours conferred on lazy runners who won by cutting corners. The element of fairness needs burning in a furnace to be restored to rawness. The ox respects its harness. Aeneas swaps the blueness of Dido's Gulf of Tunis for consciousness's anus, the system at Avernus. Perfection is a menace. The Erechtheian's cornice, the Liebestod of Linus, a pair of Nike trainers. A life of gourmet dinners. Yes, we have no bananas. No other face as soon as you fall for Valentino's. Bing Crosby, king of crooners, blue-ribboned ocean liners. Of all the Bach B minor's delights, it's countertenors. Anonymous as pennies of flawless diamonds miners. Siena's urban planners, the Taj Mahal's designers. As sturdy as lianas, the look of Tarzan's sinews. Of comforts, marijuanas, or failing that, nirvanas. What expert piano tuners accomplish with their spanners. The boys you meet in saunas who can't conceal their boners. The Virgin Mary's cleanness, an English valley's greenness. At Wimbledon, the tennis of Errol Flynn, the penis. The motion of Adonis between the thighs of Venus. The bridge of sighs at Venice. Perfection is a menace. By contrast, misdemeanors, mere lapses of good manners or good taste by lesser sinners, are treated as if heinous. As fatherly as Cronus, the mother of all diners, his hide as thick as rhinos, undaunted by harpooners, gaunt Eroses on schooners. The whale subsumes the highness and dryness of its Jonas with peristaltic slow as any anus horribilis is finis. Oh, it's almost time to finis. My love, I'm waiting for the phone to ring, for you to answer all the messages I left, or for at least some other friend to bring relief to my bereft expectancy, a call out of the blue that I might for a moment hope was you. I wonder where you are and what you're doing, as if I hadn't guessed, as if the fact of knowing who else you're eating with, or even screwing, could set my mind at rest. I've been too easygoing. I bet you're plastered, too drunk to care, you egocentric bastard. I used to be your most naive believer. It doesn't take a Freud to see I should evade interpreting my phone's inert receiver. But call me paranoid. You're either getting laid or on your own at home, not deigning to pick up the phone. That's far more likely. Loftily detached, you monitor your calls. Your answering machine, equipped with diplomatic skills unmatched by any go-between, indifferently stalls both foe and friend alike. Do you not care whom you offend? I languish here, entangled in the flex without a chaperone, soft-fingering your number as if caressing someone's flaccid sex to rouse it from its slumber. Perhaps it's not the phone, but you who's dead. Perhaps I need a Ouija board instead. Is there anybody there? One knock for yes, two knocks for no. Who would have thought we'd not outlast the rigor mortis of your cock, our silence from a plot by Edgar Allan Poe? How I'd rejoice even to hear an insult in your voice. My spicy fantasies of you have ceased to work. I may be lonely, but you're the bloody wanker. If not for your neglect, I could at least attempt a dash of rancor. You see, if you would only communicate, I might feel able to reciprocate. And I'll just read one last one, a sonnet somewhere. The two last men executed for sodomy in this country were a man called John Smith and a man called James Pratt. And Charles Dickens, when he visited Newgate Jail...